You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, May the 16th. Thanks for joining us for this Friday Week in Review. We invite you to join in with your thoughts, questions, observations from the news this week at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We will talk about international, national, and state politics in this weekly roundup with two guests from different perspectives. We'll probably start with the presidential campaign and presidential campaign politics and all that went on this week along those lines. Let me welcome our guests. Owen Robinson is a conservative blogger with bootsandsabers.com. He's also a columnist with the West Bend Daily News. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And Tony Palmieri is also with us, Associate Professor of Communications at UW-Oshkosh, a media columnist with The Valley Scene. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning, Owen, also.
Good morning, Tony.
Well, as I said, we'll start with the presidential campaign politics. Lots of stuff happening this week, but this is the very latest issue, the very latest flap going on from the New York Times this morning. President Bush used a speech to the Israeli parliament yesterday to liken those who would negotiate with terrorists and radicals to appeasers of the Nazis, a remark widely interpreted as a rebuke to Senator Barack Obama, who has advocated greater engagement with countries like Iran and Syria. Mr. Bush did not mention Mr. Obama by name, and White House officials said he was not taking aim at the senator, though they were aware that the speech might be interpreted that way. The episode placed Mr. Bush squarely in one of the most divisive debates of the campaign to succeed him, as Republicans try to portray Mr. Obama as weak in the fight against terrorism. It is also underscored that the White House has said it will be aggressive. There will be an aggressive effort by Mr. Bush to use his presidential platform to influence the presidential election. Democrats were upset with the president saying this in his speech before the Israeli parliament. Senator Hillary Clinton came to Barack Obama's defense, saying that President Bush's comparison of any Democrat to Nazi appeasers is offensive and outrageous, especially in light of his failures in foreign policy. This is the kind of statement that has no place in a presidential address. Barack Obama accused the president of launching a false political attack and said he had no intention of dealing with terrorists. Well, I could go on and on, but that's in a nutshell the very latest. Tony Palmieri, what's your reaction to this?
The irony is that after he leaves Israel, President Bush goes to Saudi Arabia and gives a blessing to nuclear energy creation in Saudi. 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia. So if anyone is doing any appeasing here, it is President Bush. I think the Democrats have actually been a little bit too mellow in their responses to his comments. It's President Bush who's doing the appeasing, not Barack Obama's plan to have some dialogue with people who, whether anyone likes it or not, are going to be involved in stabilizing the Middle East.
Owen Robinson, who's doing the appeasing?
Well, given all the complaints of the left about the wars in Iraq and such, it's kind of interesting to hear that that's appeasement. But in any case, you know, I think that the comments that the White House press secretary gave in regarding this are pretty accurate. That Obama or Bush's statements were a broad indictment of a large segment of the left's attitude towards foreign policy, but it was not specific to Obama. And the fact that he's taking that way and trying to play the victim is somewhat comical and speaks a bit to his ego. But I do find the comment, though, very interesting, to saying that this has no place in a presidential election. Talking about a foreign policy stance, whether we will engage in direct diplomacy or whether we'll be more aggressive or that is very much things we need to talk about in a presidential election. So,
yeah, maybe I misspoke. She said it had no place in a presidential address before the Israeli parliament.
No, but I guess I don't see why not? I mean, he's talking to the Israelis on their 60th anniversary, a time when they're celebrating. They've been fighting for 60 years just to exist, and to talk about appeasement and things like that are certainly very apropos at that point. And it's very, very relevant in our presidential election. How we're going to deal with the terrorists after Bush is out of office is something that we need to be clear about and something we need to have some understanding about with our presidential candidates so we can make an informed choice.
Tom?
Well, like, I think the national media, just as usual, is just got the picture upside down. President Bush goes to Saudi Arabia, a nation that produced the 9/11 terrorists, and the president gives a blessing to nuclear power in Saudi Arabia. I mean, Owen, do you want to see Saudi Arabia as a nuclear nation?
Not as a nuclear nation, no.
So did the president go there and appease them?
Nation are two separate things.
What would you call what President Bush did in Saudi Arabia, appeasement?
No, I would not.
Why not? Here's Barack Obama, a presidential candidate, who's saying it's time to open up dialogue. And here's the president, a person in power.
Hold on. We got two of you talking at once.
15 of the 19 terrorists who committed the 9/11 terrorist actions were from Saudi Arabia. Nobody denies that. However, it wasn't a state-sponsored action. So what would you have Bush do? Would you have him go to war in Saudi Arabia? Would you have him drive up oil to $200 a gallon? I guess I'm trying to see, Tony, what would you have Bush do and not criticize it with Saudi Arabia there?
I would have Bush do, and I know this has been very difficult for him over the last 7.5 years, is to try to be rational in foreign policy. What Obama has called for...
That's not what I asked.
What Obama has called for is exactly the opposite of appeasement. He's talking about some rationality in American foreign policy. And let's put an end to this needless saber rattling. Do we really want more war, Owen? A war with Iran? A war with Syria? At this point? I don't understand the purpose of President Bush's remarks. Is he saying that we need to be even more belligerent in the Middle East? Hasn't there been enough of that in the last 7 years?
All right, Owen, what's wrong with Barack Obama saying that, under some circumstances, he would talk with leaders of Iran and Syria because we need to negotiate with these countries?
The difference is what Obama has advocated is direct negotiation from the presidential stance. So he's talking direct negotiations, the president, the secretary of state type level, speaking with a foreign power. When America, as a world leader, does that, they legitimize whoever they're speaking with. So, for instance, if President Bush went over and had sit-down meetings with Hamas, it legitimizes that regime and gives them power, both within the region and both within the world. That's what's wrong with it. One has to be conscious of the effects that a direct foreign policy like that has to have. Now, that is utterly different than having very low-level talks about specific issues, about engaging them in a very controlled, in a very measured format, so which is what Secretary of Defense Gates has advocated in Iran, for instance, and something that we're actively doing. So what Obama is saying is that, he has said very specifically that he himself would go have direct talks with people, that, with foreign dictators, with tyrants, with terrorists. And what that does is lend the prestige of the American nation to those dictators, to those terrorists, and give them power both within their own world and within our world.
Yeah, let me ask you, Tony. John McCain said yesterday when asked about this, I think that Barack Obama needs to explain why he wants to sit down and talk with a man who is the head of a government that is a state sponsor of terrorism, that is responsible for the killing of brave young Americans, that wants to wipe Israel off the map, who denies the Holocaust. That's what I think Senator Obama ought to explain to the American people.
You know, I think if Senator McCain wants to continue to attach himself to President Bush's foreign policy, more power to him. I mean, I don't think it's going to get him much in the electorate. The fact of the matter is that neither Bush nor McCain have any realistic, feasible plan to create peace in the Middle East, to end the war in Iraq, and then to try and turn the tables and somehow make Barack Obama and his campaign the problem with American foreign policy. I mean, I just find it outrageous.
Owen?
Well, I think that McCain has advocated a foreign policy that is similar to Bush's, but slightly different. But I would again ask, Tony just made the charge that they have no plan for peace in the Middle East and yada, yada, yada. Where's Obama's plan? If we yank out our troops within 90 days or 6 months or whatever he's saying this week, how will that create peace in the Middle East? And how, or is it just that as long as Americans don't get killed, that's okay?
No, I agree with you. I don't think any of the candidates have been very clear about what they want to do with Iraq, and I'm disappointed in all of them. But I think we all ought to be able to agree that what Bush and I think now McCain are proposing just has not worked. We've now had 7 years of nonstop war. It has not worked. I mean, at what point do we turn the page and say it's time to start new approaches?
I think that we should always be open to new approaches and new avenues and looking for success. I think we've seen our strategy in Iraq evolve and our tactical situation in Iraq evolve over the last 7 years. And I think to say that it's been an utter failure is just flat out wrong. We've seen great progress in Iraq. We see much less violence. We see many more areas of Iraq that are perfectly secure, that are safe. We see infrastructure being built. We see their oil output now matching pre-war levels. We see the Iraqi government taking, fighting the Shiite militias into their own hands and being successful with it. We see a lot of progress in Iraq. We see a functioning democracy. We see leaders who honestly I didn't think would be able to hold power for as long as they have, now becoming secure in power and able to function. No, it hasn't gone as fast as anybody would have liked. No, it hasn't been as clean as anybody would have liked, but there has been progress, and it's if we pull out right now and abandon them, what you will see is wholesale chaos.
We need to take a short pause, talking with Owen Robinson, who's a columnist with the West Bend Daily News and a blogger for bootsandsabers.com, and Tony Palmieri, who is a media columnist for the Valley Scene and also an associate professor of communications at UW-Oshkosh. We are reviewing the news of the week, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We'll spend a few more minutes on presidential campaign politics and then move on to other areas. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned for At Issue with Ben Marins this afternoon between 4 and 6. After 4, it's your views on the news. Every Friday after 4, Ben and his guest will talk with you about what you think is the most important news story of the week. We are talking about many important news stories of the week with two guests from different perspectives. It's our Friday Week in Review. Let's just quickly go through some of the other highlights, headlines from the presidential campaign this week, and just get you to both comment briefly on the significance of these. Hillary Clinton wins the West Virginia primary by a big margin, 41 points. Does it matter, Tony Palmieri?
I guess it's in the category of too little, too late. Obama's lead in the pledged delegates is just so large at this point that as it's been said many times on your and other shows, her only hope at this point is for the so-called superdelegates to come through for her, and it's not looking like that will happen at this point.
Mm-hmm. Owen?
I agree with Tony on that regard. It is too little, too late for the Clinton campaign. However, I do think that given the overwhelming margins that Clinton took in certain segments of the population, that has to concern the leaders of the Democrat Party about their now nearly anointed candidate here for the November election.
Should they be worried about the working class not backing Barack Obama at this point, Tony?
Sure. Of course, they need to be concerned about that. And actually, one problem that Obama has had, and I think most of his critics on the left and right have said this, is that he does speak in generalities. He needs to start taking the policy lead in this campaign. I mean, for example, I thought the idea from Hillary and McCain for the gas tax holiday, you know, I thought it was a bad idea. But the fact of the matter is they were taking the policy lead. And Obama seems to always be in a position of responding to the policy ideas of the other candidates. I think if he wants support of all voters, not just white working class, he needs to be a public policy leader and get beyond the generalities.
He was stumping for the auto worker vote in Michigan, Barack Obama, that is, was, and John Edwards joined him there and endorsed Barack Obama, the long-awaited John Edwards endorsement. Owen, do you think that'll make any difference?
Well, I find the whole Edwards endorsement kind of puzzling. For one, he's a one-term senator with two failed runs for higher office. I don't know why his endorsement matters to anybody. On the other hand, it came so late, after the North Carolina primary, after Obama's basically already, you know, cinched the nomination. What good does that do?
Do you think it does any good, Tony?
At this point, I think endorsements by people like John Edwards are just designed to get the other so-called superdelegates on board. And I think he's hoping that people like Russ Feingold and Herb Kohl in Wisconsin will just finally come out and say that they'll endorse Obama or Hillary. So that's the only relevance I can see of the endorsement at this point.
So do you think, Owen Robinson, that Hillary Clinton wants to be asked to be vice president?
I do not think so. At this point, what it seems to me is you know, the Clintons are smart. They have run a number of successful campaigns. They know how to read the tea leaves. I don't think that it's realistic to think at this point that Hillary Clinton has any notions that she will actually win the nomination. I believe what she's looking ahead to do is to damage Obama enough where he loses to McCain. McCain will very likely be a one-term president because of his age, and he's kind of said that. He's put out feelers there. But she can't damage Obama if she's not in the race. If she drops out of the race and attacks Obama, she will lose loyalty within the party. However, as long as she's a candidate, she can keep throwing blows until she's out. So I think that's her end right now.
What do you think, Tony?
I honestly think she believes she still can get the nomination. Mm-hmm. Until those superdelegates come out of the shadows, there is still a mathematical possibility for her to be the nominee. And I think she believes that if Obama is tarnished enough, that maybe the superdelegates may come through for her. I mean, it's obviously not likely, but I think she believes that it still can happen. And, you know, people keep making a comparison between Obama and JFK. For years, the historians have said that JFK offered Lyndon Johnson the VP nomination, thinking that there would be no way he'd ever take it, but that he would be seen as offering it to this powerful Senate leader. And I'm wondering if the same thing is going on here. I mean, Obama may offer it to Hillary just to be able to appease, if you will, huge parts of the Democratic base. And then, who knows, she may turn around and actually take it. And I really don't think Barack Obama wants Hillary on the ticket.
Yeah, well, 55% of the Democrats asked in this Gallup poll out this week said they wanted Hillary on the ticket. Way more Hillary Clinton supporters than Barack Obama supporters wanted that. Do you think there's any chance, Owen, that might happen?
Well, there's always a chance, but I don't think it's likely. I think that Clinton brings a lot of baggage to the ticket that Obama doesn't need. She doesn't really bring the executive leadership and length of experience that ticket needs. I suspect he'll go for somebody with executive experience, somebody who perhaps older with, you know, bring some, as they said in the 2000 election, that brings some gravitas to the ticket.
Yeah. Let's move on to some other issues, and we have callers, so let me let a caller change the subject for us. Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Thank you, Joy. Mm-hmm. After presidential politics, I hope that what's foremost on people's minds is this deplorable job our state legislature is doing, maybe the worst legislative session in the history of the state. This budget, so-called budget fix, is an insult where they keep on using accounting tricks year after year to push to future sessions the responsibilities we have now. And this ruse of delaying payments to schools is just ridiculous. And for, again, refinancing the tobacco settlement, do these guys have any accountability whatsoever to the people? Or are they just working for the special interest you know, even Wisconsin Manufacturers of Commerce now is endorsing the hospital tax, which would really generate more Medicare funding from the federal government while generating revenue that could help balance the budget. And I would like to see both of your panelists degrade this legislature and put them in their place. I don't see how anybody can possibly defend these votes that were taken this week in the Senate and Assembly.
Does anyone want to degrade the legislature?
Well, I will. I agree with almost everything that Steve said. The most tragic part of this is that most of these characters will run unopposed or with token opposition in the fall. And I think that's unfortunate. I think the people have to take some responsibility for that. If we are as angry as Steve is, and as I think most of us should be, then we ought to be having more candidates challenge the incumbents, and we are not seeing that. Yeah, I know that the campaign finance system is broken, and that makes it more difficult to put challengers up there. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, our legislators in Madison have calculated that they can pull off this nonsense, this lack of accountability, and get away with it. So it's time for citizens, I think, to just kind of step up to the plate and say, let's remove these people from office and let's have responsible, accountable budgeting for change.
Yeah. Do you have problems with this this budget, Owen Robinson?
The budget, quote unquote, repair bill.
Yeah, the budget repair bill. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a horrible piece of legislation. It's trickery. It's pushing spending into the next budget instead of dealing with it now. So we'll just have to deal with it then. Senator Ellis came out saying with a statement, he crunched the numbers and said that, you know, with this budget fix, we went to fix a $652 million budget deficit. What we've done is now create an $846 million deficit for the next cycle. So yeah. Done nothing to fix it. I disagree that raising taxes, especially in a sluggish economy with $4 gas and rising food prices, that putting that burden on the back of the taxpayers is the wrong thing to do. However, just pushing away spending and driving up debt is not the way to handle it. We should have done some responsible budget changes and some control our spending for once. You know, what's so irritating about that entire fix is we went in with over $500 million of budget deficit, and there is not a single realistic cut in spending in there. All it is a bunch of tricks. That's all it is.
Yeah. Well, what, Tony, do you think that, what do you want the governor to do? He's got his partial veto pen poised. What do you think he should do with this budget repair bill?
I think he should veto the entire thing and send it back and say to the legislature, give me something serious. I mean, you know, the Senate passed this nonsense by a 17-16 vote and did not even debate it in the Senate, which is just ridiculous. But what I would like to know from Owen is, I think all of the Republicans talk about the need for more spending cuts, but yet I don't hear the spending cuts coming from them. What massive major spending cuts have they proposed that would fix our structural deficit problem? Do you know what they are?
Well, Tony, you won't find me defending the Republican leadership here, because no, they haven't offered any, and yes, it's their complete failure to do so that is a complete problem. They need to, what they should have done is propose spending or spending cuts and brought it to the table and demanded that and had something in there. The fact is what I sense from the Republican leadership at this point is that they wanted to get something through, something easy, something they thought that would be signed quick so that they can move on to the election cycle. What they've done, however, is throw away any principle or branding for the Republican name that they may have chosen to claim, and I think in the end hurt their election chances in November.
Yeah. Well, the legislature did also this week pass this Great Lakes Compact. Do they deserve any kudos for that, Tony?
I don't think so, Joy, because quite frankly, much of it was negotiated in secret. I think very few people understand what it will actually do. I suppose it's a good thing, but it would be nice if we had some sunshine in government. And if we're going to negotiate deals, they should be out in the open.
Mm-hmm. Owen?
I have difficulty arguing with that. They passed it. They passed it by an overwhelming margin. They get to stand for holy pictures by the lake. But
Let's talk about what Congress is up to these days. The Farm Bill passed. Do we like this Farm Bill, Owen Robinson?
No, we do not.
How come?
It's, you know, I've never been a supporter of farm subsidies and how we manage that that industry in America, or how we've chosen to manage it. And I don't understand, frankly, why we're, well, I understand the politics behind it, but not the rationality behind why we spend so much money propping up this industry in specific areas and monkeying with the free market in that regard, and we don't in other industries. But, you know, in an age where food prices are going through the roof, where we're paying double, triple, quadruple what we did just a couple years ago for food, farmers are making millions. Why do they need government handouts to keep their business going? It's a complete handout to special interests is what it really is, trying to bring votes to more politicians.
Mm-hmm. Tony, what do you think?
I agree with much of what Owen said. I mean, the you know, giving of tax subsidies to millionaires, which exists in this bill, is ridiculous. But the Wisconsin congressional delegation was split, and I... Mm-hmm. You know, David Obie voted for it, and I kind of leaned toward his position, in which he said it's a bad bill, but it's probably better than the farm bill that was in place. So that would probably be the only rationale to vote for it, is that it was better than what we've had.
Yeah. Wisconsin Democrats Herb Kohl and Russ Feingold voted in favor of the farm bill, too, when it was approved yesterday in the Senate. So the president has threatened to veto this thing. But there might be a veto-proof majority, at least in the House?
Probably in both houses of the legislature. Yeah. It looks like, I think the Senate had 81 votes in favor of the farm bill. So if that number remains, it looks like the president may have a veto overridden for, I think, only the second time in his presidency.
Yeah.
Yep, you're correct. It would be the second time, and I think he probably will veto it, and I'm almost certain his veto will be overridden, which is a shame. The thing should be, much like the budget repair bill, it should be struck down and sent back to bring something realistic up.
Yeah. Well, Congress and the president, I think, also at odds over this GI bill. Should we have these benefits for the Iraqi war veterans? I think the problem is that they kick in after three years of service, and the Pentagon thinks that's going to give them problems with retention.
Yeah, I actually don't have a problem with a GI Bill sense where we're helping veterans go to go to college when they come back from war. As long as it's reasonably priced, I don't think that's a bad thing. I do agree, however, with the Pentagon, where they say that the 3 years is what's the problem, that it's just too short. What will likely happen is people enlist. You know, you spend a good 9 months, a year getting trained and learning how to do your job, then you're 2 years in, and then you can drop out and get a full ride scholarship to college. It doesn't seem like enough commitment. Even if you look at our military academies, they're required to serve much longer than that after going to college. So I think if the Democrats would bend and either move that year limit up, that would easily pass and with broad support.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
I disagree. I think 3 years is more than enough time to serve, to get that benefit to kick in. And quite frankly, I'm shocked that John McCain is not supporting it. I really am, especially since he presents himself as the biggest friend of the soldier. If he really was, I think he'd get out in front of on this issue.
We're going to take a short pause and invite callers. We're going to move on to some other issues in the news this week, including gas prices. Another day, another hike in gas prices. Talk a little bit about that. Talk about polar bears, talk about same-sex marriage in California, other issues in the news this week. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. You know, later today, It's Talk of the Nation Science Friday from 1 until 3 in the afternoon, and a very special Talk of the Nation Science Friday today as it's coming to you from Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Public Museum. Ira Flatow is in town, and there'll be a special broadcast of Talk of the Nation Science Friday live from the museum. You can be there. I'm pretty sure there's a room for you, a seat for you, if you want to check out our website, wpr.org. You can get more details about the broadcast. There's also a special event after the broadcast, a reception, and then there's a dinner at Mater's Restaurant. For more information, tickets, go to the website, wpr.org. After I get off the air, I'll be heading over to Milwaukee. I know that Kathleen Dunn's going to be there, and Ben Marins is going to be there, and a lot of other Wisconsin Public Radio staff, in addition to Ira Flatow. So I hope you will join us in Milwaukee today, this afternoon, tonight, for Ira Flatow and Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Right now, this is the Week in Review. I'm talking with two guests, different perspectives, about the news of the week, Tony Palmieri and Owen Robinson. And with you, we have an open line if you want to bring up something from the news this week at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. In the news this morning, just like clockwork, another day, another hike in the price of gas. AAA puts the national average cost of a gallon of regular gas at $3.79 nationwide, up a penny from yesterday. We got an email from Kurt in Springbrook who says, when are we going to hear one of the presidential candidates start talking about the end of oil? I just put those two together because they're kind of related. Tony Palmieri, what do you think?
I don't. We're certainly not hearing any serious proposals from any of the presidential candidates about things like creating a real rail system in the United States. Instead, we get pandering like the gas tax holiday. So, I mean, I agree with Kurt. I mean, I don't know if they should be talking about the end of oil. It's going to be around for a long time. But we're certainly not hearing any very serious proposals on alternative transportation and reducing dependency on oil, so I agree with him on that.
Mm-hmm. Owen?
Well, I mean, yeah, I agree. I'm not hearing much out of any of the presidential candidates regarding it, regarding any realistic solutions to it. But there's a few things that we must all keep in mind. One, that, you know, the oil market is a global market, that it's affected by things that are way outside of our control. For instance, China and India both building, with 2 billion people of the world's population, starting to build a road infrastructure, and they're buying cars, and that's really increasing demand for oil and gasoline. There's only so much America can do about it. What we can do is become more self-reliant on it, and that involves opening up areas that have previously been forbidden to drill on to let us go and drill and bring out the oil. Tony's right. Oil's going to be around for a long time. I think we all recognize that we need to find a more diverse energy portfolio to bring us energy. But oil is the foundation of the world economy right now, and to just think that we can, put it on the shelf and walk away within within the next couple decades is just fantasy.
Also in the news on the state level this week, a group of legislators wants to end tax credits for ethanol production and lift reformulated gas requirements in southeastern Wisconsin. The 24 Republican lawmakers and one Democrat wrote a letter to Wisconsin's congressional delegation saying ethanol policies have been a disaster and subsidies for it would be better spent on fuel cell technology. Is this a good idea, Owen?
Well, the whole ethanol story is really a lesson in, why we shouldn't let the government just pick things and let the free market work. The government decided that ethanol was a good thing because Arthur Daniel Midlands decided it was a good thing and paid a bunch of money to politicians to pass it through. And what we see now is the disastrous effect it's had in our economy, where as we take more and more of our corn crop and stick it into our gas tanks, we see the price of corn go up, which is a foundation crop in our diet. It feeds everything from cattle to people, that we see that going away. But in the meantime, fields are being used for corn, where previously they were used for things like soybeans and wheat, and so we see the price of those things going up as well. It's not the entire reason, but it's a contributor to our rise in food prices. At the same time, the science is bearing out that ethanol is not a clean fuel. It's less efficient. It actually takes more energy to produce a gallon of ethanol than the energy we get out of a gallon of ethanol. So the science is now bearing out that it's a bad idea. So, yeah, we should back off. I don't think that ethanol should be abandoned completely, but there's no reason to mandate it. There's no reason to subsidize it. It does have a place in the market, but let it fend for itself.
Mm-hmm. Tony?
Not much to add to that. Hey, I think ethanol has been a very overrated so-called clean source for many years. And, I think, as Owen said, it's not really a clean energy source. So it probably is time to end those subsidies.
Yeah. You know, I lost my story. I can't find my story, but it was the Interior Department said the polar bear is endangered, put it on the I'm trying to remember the exact list, the threatened species list due to the decline in Arctic sea ice from global warming. So how significant is this, Tony?
You know, I want to tie this back to presidential politics. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of talk that if McCain were to get elected, the Democrats say it would be the third term of George Bush. I actually think if McCain got elected, it would be the completion of the second term of Richard Nixon, because Nixon was actually pretty good on environmental issues, Clean Water Act, Earth Day, and many other initiatives. And McCain, I think, has rankled many Republicans by taking global warming very, very seriously. He gave a major policy speech on it the other day. So, yeah, it is significant that the Interior Department has made this designation. And I do think all the major presidential candidates, unlike President Bush, do seem committed to doing something about global climate change.
Owen.
Well, I'm disappointed. I have a whole section of my cookbook of polar bear recipes.
Oh, no, stop it.
I agree largely with Tony regarding the presidential stuff. McCain does model himself as a Teddy Roosevelt, who was a big environmentalist who really built our national park system. I do agree from that regard. As far as the issue itself, whether it's a big deal, I think it's I think whether it's a tacit recognition of the Bush administration that global warming exists, I think it's a very small part of a much larger debate.
Yeah, now we have callers I need to get to. Greg in Watertown. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Yeah, I wanted to comment that, it's really not the government that is all responsible for our energy crisis, although they certainly have a hand to play in. I think part of it is our own greed, our own the industry's control of government. There's many, many factors. There's this thing called peak phenomenon, peak oil, peak gas, and that if we continue to think in this reductionist viewpoint that it's this fault, that it's this problem, and we analyze our problem and we just think in economic terms, or we just think in one business's term, or we just think in some senators' ideas of how things should be, that we're never going to come to the crux of the problem. We'll continue to treat symptoms, and we'd better really start to think about a holistic viewpoint of the world and recognize that when we do make policy, that it's going to affect many different sectors of society, of ecology, of our economy, and and really start to get away from this age-old thinking of a mechanistic view of the world that's 400 years old. And came in the.
What would you like our guests to talk about, Greg?
I would like them to have a little bit wider viewpoint about what's going on in our society and the world, and address our issues more from a holistic perspective than a tightness focus on one specific aspect of the issue.
Yep. Do you agree with him, Tony?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's not just a governmental issue. Private industry. Every citizen is an individual. Yeah, I mean, Greg is right. We're all part of this. But, you know, we are in the middle of a presidential campaign, and so it is time for people that are getting national attention, I mean, i.e. Obama, Clinton, McCain, to come forward and introduce these issues. Like, for example, Greg mentioned peak oil. I have not heard that phrase come out of the mouth of any presidential candidate.
Mm-hmm.
So he's right. I mean, we need a broader discussion of these issues.
Owen?
I think Greg has unwittingly stumbled on the concept of supply and demand. Yes, the reason that our energy prices are rising is because there's an increasing demand for it because people increasingly want it. Now, the issue becomes is although individually we may all work to be energy efficient just to keep the cost of our energy down individually, the fact is that the only way to really slash demand is to abandon the lifestyle we've chosen. And I don't think, and other than people voluntarily doing that, you're talking about a government coming in and mandating a step backward in our standard of living, and that's not a concept of liberty that I think we should be endorsing.
Do we care that Bob Barr, the former Republican Congressman Bob Barr, is going to step into the presidential race and run apparently as a libertarian?
Well, Barr is one of about 14 people seeking that nomination. You know, it may have a marginal effect. There's people talking about it may have a Nader effect. I don't think so much. I think the people who would vote for Barr as a protest vote because they don't want to vote for McCain, if they go to the polls, they're not going to vote for McCain anyway. They're going to vote for a write-in or somebody else. So I don't think it really has a net effect on the overall outcome.
Do you, Tony?
Ron Paul has been getting a significant amount of votes in the Republican primaries. I mean, not enough to win states, obviously, but from what I've heard, the Bob Barr campaign is really aiming at the Ron Paul voters because, as all your listeners know, Ron Paul really is a libertarian, mm-hmm. but he's been running in the Republican primaries. So, I mean, you know, if Bob Barr or any other libertarian can get those Ron Paul supporters, I think it can have a real impact.
Well, let's talk about this decision in California yesterday. Same-sex couples could tie the knot in as little as a month after the California Supreme Court ruled that a gay marriage could be allowed in the state. The decision was greeted with tears, hugs, kisses by supporters and outrage by opponents who hope voters in November will approve a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says he respects the court's decision and will not support an amendment. The Conservative Alliance Defense Fund says it will ask the justices for a stay of the decision until after the election. They hope California will be added to the list of 26 states that have approved constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage. Massachusetts became the first state and until yesterday the only state that had a legal gay marriage. What do we think of this? Owen first.
I think this really, you know, despite the issue itself, it really speaks to how activist our judicial system has become in America, and it really underlines why here in Wisconsin that there, you know, just last year there was the big push for a constitutional mm-hmm. ban on gay marriage, and the reason that needed to be put into the Constitution was specifically for this reason, so that a court could not overrule that decision, and that did pass by nearly a 2-1 margin in Wisconsin. So I think it really is more of a signal to the fact that we have a bunch of judges in this nation, quite frankly, who have decided that their will and their preferences is more important than the laws passed by the duly elected members of legislatures and the other two branches of government.
Tony?
Oh, I disagree strongly. I think the majority on the California Supreme Court actually did a very conservative analysis of the California Constitution, and they actually made an analogy to the bans on interracial marriage years ago. And they found that the California Constitution does support, marriage as a fundamental right for anybody who wants it. But, you know, Joy, I see this as a generational issue. If you talk to young people in America, people under 30, a huge majority of them have no problem at all with same-sex marriage. And I think we're going to reach a point within the next 10 or 15 years where this will be widely, widely accepted. As those folks get older and start voting more and more involved in the political process,
mm-hmm. Owen.
Well, I don't know mm-hmm. as far as whether it's a generational issue. I think we find that when you poll young people, that oftentimes they are much, much more liberal than, and as they age, they tend to trend more conservative. That's been true on almost every issue for many, many years. I suspect that will hold true on this issue. Whether or not that trend brings it to a majority or not is hard to say.
We'll get one caller in on this topic. Deborah in Rice Lake.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. My comment mainly is there's a lot of things in the news this week that are upsetting to me, but primarily this one about the gay marriage in California. What's upsetting to me is not, you know, the idea that there are, you know, that people have sexual preferences that are different than mine or that are different. The issue for me is that the English language, I used to be able to say, you know, that people used to be able to say they were gay and happy, you know, that they had a definition. It meant something to be gay was to be happy and joyful. And we used to be able to put rainbows up in our kids' rooms, and it was a beautiful thing. And now the word marriage is being changed, the definition of marriage is being changed from the union of a man and a woman to procreate the species is now being challenged and made into something else.
All right. You want to react to that, Tony?
Well, there are quite a few heterosexual married people who cannot procreate for a variety of reasons. I don't think we would take their marriage license away. So procreation cannot be the grounds for what constitutes a marriage. The California Supreme Court was essentially saying the Constitution stands for happiness for all people. We have a category of people who will be happy if they are allowed this same fundamental right. And the California Supreme Court could not find a basis, at least the majority of them, for turning that down.
Yeah, we've got lots of calls on this, but we don't have time. Do you have a brief comment on that, Owen?
I would just say, you know, as far as the caller is concerned, yes, there is an evolution of language that's very frustrating when you say things and they don't mean what you think they say anymore. But I think this issue will continue to evolve.
It's commencement weekend, UW-Madison and a number of other UW system campuses giving graduates their diplomas this weekend. In our final minute, Tony, any advice to the graduating seniors?
I would tell them spend more time in face-to-face interaction than you do behind the computer, except if you're reading Owen's blog. That's a good use of time behind a computer.
And Owen, briefly?
I agree. They should all read Boots and Beer. I would say read. Read the Constitution. Read read the foundational documents of our nation and the philosophy upon which our natural rights were based.
Good advice for everybody. Owen, Tony, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joy. Thanks, Tony.
Bye.
Thanks, Owen, bye-bye.
Owen Robinson, blogger with BootsAndSabres.com, columnist with the West Bend Daily News. Tony Palmieri, media columnist for the Valley Scene, also an associate professor of communications at UW-Oshkosh. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing the hour. Thanks to Sarah Carroll for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.